Welcome to Geeks On, a show created by geeks for geeks, covering topics that geeks like to talk about. This week, it's Geeks On 3D. 3-D. For more information and news we talk about in the show, go to our website at www.geekson.com. Hello, everybody!
Yay!
It's another episode of Geeks On, and I'm sitting in the room. I'm the only original Geeks On member right now, so I have guests here to cover the slots, but it's going to be very interesting. My name is Aaron Hendricks, and I'm a graphic designer here in Los Angeles, and I'm a geek.
My name is Brad Grusnick. I'm an actor and a writer here in Los Angeles, and I am an alternate to the geeks.
I'm Eric Kurland. I'm the president of the LA 3D Club. I'm a filmmaker and stereographer, and I am a geek too.
I'm Shannon Benna, and I am a filmmaker and stereoscopic 3D consultant and founder of Stereo Sisters, a women's 3D community, and I'm such a geek.
Well, you've noticed we have some 3D experts here. So if you guys put on your 3D glasses right now, the rest of this episode is going to be in 3D.
I do most of my work with my glasses off. It's cool.
Oh, I wear mine all the time.
So. Yeah.
Something really interesting about oral 3D. Yeah.
Exactly. So anyway, thank you guys for joining us on this panel. But before we get into the topic, I have some geek news and some stuff I did this geek week. This
nice.
Is something that we traditionally do. One of the things we did, and actually you, Shannon, were involved with this, is I had a game day and got to play a couple of games. I finished off playing a superhero game, a new card game called it's called Legendary. It's a Marvel Universe deck-building superhero game. The reason why I wanted to play it is because there are two other games that I played, which was a DC Heroes card game and a generic superhero card game. Strangely enough, superhero board games just don't exist. You'd think it would be the perfect thing to make these.
Oh, I noticed that the box is the DC game is for the New 52, and it's kind of amazing that there hasn't been a deck-building game before that.
No, there really hasn't. These are all brand new as of, like, last couple months. They all the sudden
that's really
out.
Weird.
I will say, after playing all three, the big, you know, DC Comics is behind one of them, Marvel Comics is behind the other, and then a small little company, game company, is behind the other. The one I like the most comes from the small little game company of generic superheroes, because it feels like you're playing a superhero and fighting these villains.
Oh, nice. So, do you feel like when you play the game that's from the generic company that you don't have those constraints that you would normally have with the other characters, where you're like, oh, I got stuck with Aquaman?
Well,
you
know.
do they have any established characters? Or
no established characters on that one game, but they have, like, it's kind of cheeky that, like, they have the Almighty Raw.
Okay.
So it's okay. Not Thor, but it's
right.
Just,
gotcha.
The Egyptian equivalent.
Right. They
exactly.
have like a Batman-y
Is
type
that a Watchmen
person.
Throwback, though?
No, it's none. There's just literally they made it up.
Uh-huh.
But it's a cooperative game, meaning you're not playing against each other. So you're playing a team of superheroes that
okay.
are fighting against a villain. So you feel like you are cooperating. You're like helping each other out and healing each other and trying to, you know, fight down the baddies as the plot unravels, which is exactly what you want in a superhero game. The DC game says it is cooperative, but it's not at all. I mean, actually, it doesn't really say it's cooperative. Each person is playing a superhero. Like, yeah, I got Aquaman, I get Spider-Man, or, I mean, Batman. But the problem is you're playing against each other, so theme-wise, it doesn't make any sense.
It might just be a prequel showing that the Justice League movie won't work, because...
but then again, I mean,
doubts.
People have personalities, and not everybody gets along, certainly.
Yeah, but you're literally sending bad guys over to fight... Like, Superman sending bad guys over to fight Batman.
So they're egocentric superheroes.
I guess.
Well, you know, if you're
so
Superman...
That's so realistic.
You're like, oh, I can't handle this. I'm going to send this to the guy with no powers.
Well, So then I decided, well, I'll play the Marvel one. It says it's co-op. And I went, all right, this is going to be great. We're all a team again, fighting against the bad guys. But actually, it's not cooperative at all. You actually are you're competing against killing off... You're not sending bad guys to each other, but you're competing about killing off the bad guys, and you actually can hurt the other people. And you know,
okay.
But well, I was going to ask about that on the generic one, though.
Well, the only thing that makes it semi-cooperative is there is a way that everybody can lose.
Okay. You can either, so it's like you can't work together, but you can all die together.
Yeah, so there's a way. You can at some point go, maybe we should all work together to make sure this doesn't happen.
Right.
But after that, I'm going to try to hurt you.
Do you have to try to hurt each other? Or
if
can
you
want,
you? There is one winner in the game.
Oh.
So unlike the cooperative one, the generic one, which you all mm-hmm. win or you all lose, there is no winner. It just works better. So... Hmm.
Now, do you find, though, I mean, I don't know how many times you played the games, but in the game, in like, say, the DC game, where there is one definite winner, did you find yourself enjoying the process of sort of pitting these characters against one another?
No, the theme, because it was so, like, the theme didn't work,
oh, okay.
There's other games that are like it that I just would prefer to play.
Gotcha. Hmm.
Like, I have a wall of board games, and some of them are very similar. But what sometimes you do like is the theme is changed. Like, I want to play Western.
Oh, okay.
Okay. This happens to be a little bit like another game, but the flavor is enough to feel like you're playing a Western. So if it's just a crap game, I'd just rather play the other version,
right.
Even if Superman's in it.
It sounds like it would be more interesting, like the DC game, if it was super villains pitted against each other.
That Ooh. Would be really good.
That's an awesome idea.
Exactly.
I want to play that.
You'd all be rivals and, you know, turn the heroes against
each people. Other.
There you go.
Or what, you could choose to be a superhero or a supervillain.
Exactly. Yeah, that's
cool.
It. In Justice League, somebody do it.
Yeah, well.
Call DC.
That ship's
it's always more fun to be the villain anyway.
Always.
But
they have better outfits.
We did have this game, and Shannon, you're not a game. You're not a hobby gamer.
No, not even close.
Shannon came over and sat down at a table, which they were about ready to start the Game of Thrones board game. Now, the Game of Thrones board game is not a short board game.
No.
It's supposed to be able to be played in like 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They dragged it out to about 6 hours.
Yeah. I think we started, like 8:30? I didn't get home till 2:30 in the morning. 3 in the morning. It was, it was a long game.
So she jumped in the deep end of the gaming. I tried to warn you.
It was fun. It was really fun. It was just really, you know, hard to wake up in 4 hours for work.
It's also a stressful game in which it plays out like the books or the TV series.
So there's no definite end. They just stop.
Just unfinished, you're right. After 6 hours, you don't know
I think
who.
That the
right.
smart thing is you have only a finite amount of turns that you can play. So it's like, you know, every time everybody plays their turn all together at the same time, then it moves the chip up to the next turn or whatever. So you can only mm-hmm. go 12 times. And that sounds like, oh, you know, only 12. Yeah. I'm thinking maybe there's a short version where you only have like 6 turns, you know?
You could all just agree to only do it in 6.
That's a, okay, truncated versions. Got it. Down with that.
There you go.
But it is an interesting game in where you're not waiting for the next person too long.
Absolutely.
You're literally all playing together, which is a well-designed game in my opinion. So
that's also like the books because it's constantly happening all at the same time.
It is.
Absolutely. And you can really change, you know, you can say to your neighbor, oh yeah, I'm totally going to help you out. No problem. But everybody gives orders to all of their different areas and troops and ships and whatnot all at the same time on these little tokens. And then at the same moment, everybody flips them over. So you discover at that moment if you've been screwed over or if people have followed through with what they said they were going to do. And now there's a whole, then you got to fight all these battles or not, you know, depending.
If you got screwed or not.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the great part of the game is the backstabbing.
It is. It's
emotional.
It's a lot of fun.
It's kind of an emotional game.
It was great. I enjoyed being vicious. It was cool.
I could hear yells and screaming from the table for 6 hours. So.
Oh, your neighbor liked that a lot, too.
I'm sure he hated that. Anybody else have anything interesting in the geek realm over the week happen to them?
I actually just started playing God of War 3. I know I'm all of 2 years behind, but I think what I'm doing it in prep for God of War Ascension, which comes out on March 12th. So I think what I love about those games is that they do a great job of creating scenarios in which you power up. So when you receive a new power, you receive a new weapon, the villain that you have to beat and the story that you have to go through in order to accrue one of those things is really woven together well. And I think I really dig the storytelling that they've done with these games.
You don't open
games.
Up a treasure chest, grab something no. better. You literally have to go rip off Medusa's head, take out her, and then you get the power of turning people
exactly.
to
stone.
Oh.
Yeah, that's what, like in the last one, they do this thing where you have to you start going through the pantheon of gods. You're defeating them, which is cool because ultimately we know that the Greek gods aren't around anymore. So it shows like, okay, well, this is sort of how they fell. Mm-hmm. But as you go through, you do stuff where it's like you beat Helios, and then with the sun god's power, you can find things that were hidden before by shining his head on stuff. So I just think it's really cool the way that they put that stuff together.
You literally dismantle the Greek mythos. The video game is you go systematically and kill everything that you know in the Greek mythos. It's interesting.
It's really good. So I know I'm 2 years behind on that, but...
hey, this is the first I've heard of it.
Yeah, so churning through that in preparation for the prequel that comes out in a month. So, where we learn how this guy started getting into this and being able to kill gods.
So. Yeah, because they killed absolutely everything. They have to go back in time exactly. and start over again. You know what? Let's kill those guys again.
And then they right. run into Marty prequel, McFly.
No. Yeah, those guys, yeah, get those guys.
Wow.
So.
Congratulations to 2000.
I know, right? Yeah, wait, 2010. All the way back in 2010.
Hey, I just started playing Skyrim again.
Well, the Skyrim is one of those games that you can
play
sort
forever.
Of, you can come back to. I mean, it is about as close to, an MMO that you can get on a console.
Right. This is the game that's essentially Dungeons & Dragons video game.
Cool.
Essentially.
I like pinball.
It's actually, there's some new pinball, like digital pinball games that are out like on iPad and Xbox.
Yeah.
With Star Wars one coming out, Empire Strikes Back, and I think they have the Avengers, and they're freaking good.
Do they have that same, because you have the iPad and you can sort of
can
move back
it?
And forth? Yeah, does it have that visceral feeling that you have when you actually play a pinball game?
I play them on my Xbox because I like the larger screen, because it's hard to see a full table. Hmm. So the bigger mm-hmm. the screen, the more you get that.
Well, I have one for my iPad. It's an older one. It's Pinball Run or something like that. And, you know, I'm cheap, so I haven't got the full version. But it does have some haptic feedback, and you can tilt. Well, I don't know that I've ever actually tilted full on, but you definitely can bump the machine and, you know, make some differences. And they actually give you good points for that sort of manipulation. It's pretty cool. And then there's another one I actually got one of the new 3D, well, it's an old new 3D tablet this weekend, which is sort of a Weekend Geek kind of cool thing. What's the tablet called?
It's called the Neo 3DO.
Yeah, it's
like
the GadMate tablet, right?
It's a Chinese-made auto-stereoscopic tablet that's going to be available here sometime in March.
And I was really excited to find that there was they said 3D, mm-hmm, but this is, you know, this will lead us into that caveat of what does 3D really mean, pinball game, but it's actually like playing in the universe, so there's this giant black hole that's in the center, and it has flippers that kind of extend out from around it, and then you can bounce the ball off of sort of like
planets,
things, not planets, but they're, it's almost like, you know, 2001, and there are
actually,
a bunch of
think I have that game on my 3D phone.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
But it wasn't 3D, it was just CG 3D modeled. It wasn't actual stereoscopic 3D.
I can't imagine even if it was 3D you would get that much.
Oh,
on a pinball machine.
Because you can turn. It's all based on how you move the tablet. It's not you bump it onto things. It's almost like monoliths are floating in space, and this ball, you bounce it off of all of these floating things, and it's completely circular and three dimensional, like a sphere. Space.
Sounds like Breakout, like a 3D Breakout.
Yeah,
in the 80s. The
bumping. Remember, it's Arkanoid on the old NES.
Right,
it's sort of the same.
Or
game.
Breakout. They had Breakout.
Yeah.
Aaron, you were at the Consumer Electronics Show. Did you see the company that was selling consumer pinball machines and they like licensed all the Marvel
properties? Walked past it. My dad was with me, so we were kind of blew past some of those things, but so I didn't get to look at them.
They had an Avengers pinball, and I think they had a Spider-Man pinball.
Like, I also don't have $7,500 sitting around for a pinball machine.
Well, there's a great app, though, that you can get on your phone. It's called the Pinball Map, and not only can you find all of the pinball machines that are in your area in most larger cities and some smaller ones. I spent some time in my hometown in Iowa this winter, and they had Omaha, on there. So it was pretty cool.
It says you're here and blah, blah. And you hit the button and it pinpoints on a map where there are pinball machines?
I don't know if it necessarily does that. You can break it down by location. You can break it down by machine. And you can break it down by, I guess, like state, kind of. So if you're looking for a specific machine, you can look it up and it'll say, okay, there's one over here in Michigan. And then there's one over here in LA, over here, and blah, blah, blah.
Wow.
And you can also add your own that you discover because it's, you know, sort of user populated. And I actually added quite a bit of it. And continue to do so.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I found that one of my favorite machines I've ever played is the Rolling Stones game. It was really, really awesome. And, you know, it has Mick Jagger dancing. And there's a tongue with a mouth. The ball can kind of go up and down. It's really, really
cool. It's kind of amazing which of those pinball machines you go, this was the most amazing pinball machine I've ever played. Which one? Addams Family. The Addams Family is one of the most notoriously famous pinball machine games, and people would be
the
Addams Family?
Rarely connected to how good the actual game is.
Yeah.
Well, there's a pinball museum in Las Vegas.
I know.
It's just like a warehouse with several hundred vintage pinball machines. Well, but they're all there. You can play them all.
Every time I go to Vegas for NAB, I never make it to that party, which, you know, I have to make an effort to do. But there's also a cool place here in LA called Pins and Needles.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a private pinball club.
Do you know the woman's name?
Yeah.
Well, anyway,
she's... I don't recall her name off the top of my head. But, yeah, she has her own collection of pinball machines that she opens up like one day a week. The public,
I think it's Tuesdays.
Really?
Yeah.
And she runs the Los Angeles Pinball League.
Oh, wow.
And you can BYOB play. But, you know, when that's not open, I also go up to Stefano's Two Guys from Italy on Hollywood Boulevard and play their Theater of Magic game. It's a really good mechanical game. It's got really good weight, not a lot of magnets or any of that weird stuff. So it's actually, you can feel.
You went flippers and bumpers only.
Yep. I don't like that magnetic crap that, you know.
Redirects.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
There's a great documentary called Special When Lit.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very, like, it's all about sort of the history of pinball machines and what they meant. And, like, at one point they were thought of as gambling machines. So there was almost a prohibition on them where they would, like, pull them out of bars and destroy them.
I think that's on Netflix.
Yeah, it's on Netflix.
Very cool.
And it's, that's really good. That's really good. And then Indie Game, the movie, I don't know if anybody has seen that, but that's about the guys that did Super Meat Boy and just them prepping to put Super Meat Boy on the Xbox Live platform. And so it's about indie gamers, but it follows them and follows other guys. But that's also an instant. That's really good.
Very cool.
Well, tangents. That's what the show's about.
Okay. No, shangents. Shangents.
Here's some quick news. I thought it was interesting. A judge rules that it is illegal to sell custom Batmobiles because the Batmobile itself is a fictional character.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so this guy, Mark Towell, who in L.A. runs a custom car shop called Gotham Garage, where he makes those 60s Batmobiles and sells them. And, of course, we have Warner Brothers calling him up saying, you can't do that. So it actually went to court. And here's the strange thing is that instead of saying something like, well, we own the pictorial graphic and image of the Batmobile, which was what I think you would normally do.
Yeah.
They brought up that it was actually copywritten because it's a character.
Kind of like the Kit car from Knight Rider?
Yeah. So, well, but that's what it is. This is a non-sentient.
Yeah. Well, so did they specify that it's any iteration of the Batmobile or just specific copies? Is like, say there's there's the 1960s Batmobile, there's the 89 Batmobile.
I'm not quite sure if they went to every little one, but the judge said that the Batmobile is a character.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Because normally you would have to, vehicles normally fall under patents. And patents are like utility things, like gadgets and functional things. So you wouldn't get a patent on a Batmobile.
Right. I would think you could trademark a particular Batmobile.
That's where trademark.
A specific thing is like with the General Lee. And it was like, Herbie the Love Bug.
You would say, I own this piece of art
Because intellectual property.
Yes, exactly. And but that's not what the judge ruled on. The judge ruled that it was actually a character, and so it fell under copyright that way.
I would be surprised if that did not lose an appeal, only because people can customize their cars however they want. So it's like, this is, I want to customize this. But is it just because he's selling it, billing it as like, I sell Batmobiles?
Yeah.
Oh, well, okay.
But like, if you... like,
I have friends, well, did have friends, whatever, that did, like, children's parties. And you can't be, you can be a princess, but try to actually copy Sleeping Beauty and get away with it. You're going to get in trouble. Right. You can do it, but you'll probably get popped. You know, you can be a animated character, but you can't be Pokemon, you know, Pikachu.
See,
unless you're licensed.
You can be a purple dinosaur, but you can't be Barney.
Exactly, exactly.
Well,
so you can be a high-tech, gadgeted superhero mobile, but you can't be the Batmobile.
Right. Well, then I understand.
A character who is a generic super spy doesn't infringe upon a character of James Bond, but if your super spy is British, wears a tux, and drinks vodka martini shaken, the chances are you're in violation.
So paint the car gray and call it the Ratmobile and be done with it.
Perfect.
Wow.
I just thought it was interesting that they won on the whole character thing.
Well, I do. I just find it interesting because people are able to customize their car. So say if somebody decides to airbrush the Hulk on the hood of their car, are they in violation?
Yes. Okay, this is really interesting because last year I actually ended up going to Comic-Con for the first time because I randomly got hired to go down and try to collect signatures for these people. And we got down there, we found out what it was. And it was people who were like lobbying against copyright infringement. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there and I'm going, man, guys, do you not see where you are? This is pretty much not your audience, okay? Just in case you were wondering, pretty much 90% of the people here are all interested in, you know, cosplay and stuff based on copyright infringement.
Yeah.
You know, there are 17 billion versions of the Batmobile drawn right there, and that there are lobbies set up with artists, and that's what they do. I mean, who are you trying to lobby to?
The corporations do have to try to protect their trademarks. I mean, you hear, like, every year there's a story of Disney going after a preschool somewhere that has a mural of Mickey Mouse on the wall.
Well, right.
And you think that's, you know, you think it's ridiculous, but if they don't protect it, then that is an open door for later people to prove that they have lost their copyright.
Right. People will run rampant if they don't go after everybody when it's actually a problem.
The whole thing's screwed up. Yeah. Patent, copyright, the whole thing's so screwed.
Yeah, copyright law, the Sonny Bono screwed us royally.
He was in bed with Disney.
He was, well, when he was a congressman, he was in bed with Disney and got Congress to pass the whole, you know, copyrights were supposed to be, what was it, like
50 years, 70 years.
Life of the artist or something. And Sonny Bono was instrumental in allowing corporations to then become entities that could have copyrights in perpetuity. And it.
So he Bono'd us?
Yeah, so we've talked about this.
He Bono'd us.
Sorry.
So we have Disney taking other people's work and changing it and then making sure that no one else can change theirs.
Of course.
They're a bunch of assholes.
Yeah. All right. No problem.
Next mouse thing wears on a my glove list for a reason.
Mississippi drafts a bill to ban human-animal hybrids.
Oh, really? I support that.
What this actually is an anti-abortion bill, but there's weird stuff buried in it that everybody started gravitating to. For example, embryos that contain human and non-human cells, nuclei or chromosomes, embryos that were created by fertilizing a human egg with animal sperm or vice versa, and a non-human life form that is, quote, engineered with a human brain, all fits into this illegal human-animal hybrid bill.
Who's doing that?
Some politician there. The bill name is HB 819. If you want to read it, it's online.
Creepy.
It really is an anti-abortion bill. Like you start reading it, it looks like that, but then if you go through it, this stuff is in it.
Well, that actually is really smart. It's stupid, but it's really smart on their part to be like, all right, abortion is definitely a hot word, so we're going to go in and we're going to create this ridiculous bill about creating werewolves. And people will be like, yeah, sure, we don't want werewolves. You know?
We've got this swamp, we have the Swamp Thing Act in Mississippi.
Wouldn't that be plant human hybrids?
Right, exactly.
Ooh, I think I see an opening.
Right.
Let's do it.
I don't want a talking dog coming in and telling me what to do with my body.
Well, no, it says human and non-human cells do fall under that category.
Mm.
Although it does say animal sperm as another one. So I still think that embryos containing human and non-human cells fall under that.
That is pretty amazing. Now, the lengths that people will go to.
Where do they fall on, like, you know, growing a human ear on the back of a pig and then transplanting
right,
it?
Right, I know. I don't
now,
know.
That I have no problem with. I
See,
mean,
that's an animal with non-animal cells. That's perfectly fine. How else would Kentucky Fried Chicken stay in business?
No, exactly. I mean, there's this whole medical thing now, being able to grow organs for transplant. And I'm curious how that would apply.
It does say embryos that contain human and non-human cells. Well, you know, that's the same thing. They have, pigs that produce human insulin.
Yeah.
And I think they did that with human cells. They actually changed it. So that would knock that out of that category.
Right. Well,
so now
just
we just need
wording,
to get PETA to come. And
that wording, though, of human and non-human, where it's like, oh, we're just going to sweep the human part under the rug there. What? Yep.
The problem with that is...
Because I find it hard to believe that there's anyone out there trying to actually make, like, Pig Boy, you know?
I am. I don't know about you. I mean, well, that's what my garage is dedicated to.
Well, in Mississippi, they are going to make sure that...
Oh, it's Mississippi.
Oh, okay. that clears
right, exactly.
Everything up.
In California, we can create as many hybrids as we want.
Right. The last thing on my list is, just quickly, there is now a SpongeBob SquarePants porn parody that just came out.
About time. I mean, come on.
The person is actually dressed like SpongeBob.
I'm frightened.
Did not watch it.
We'll look for a review next time.
What's the title? Did you find the title?
SpongeBob SquarePants, a porn parody.
Oh, come on. They could have come up with something better than that. Like the Today SpongeBob SquarePants.
Apparently you can actually name it.
Work.
Like the same company is doing things like...
But wait, isn't that copyright infringement?
No, it's a parody.
Because it says
parody. Oh, because
parody.
It's parody.
See,
yep.
This company has made a whole bunch of them. They have like Spider-Man... The parody, and they're just putting the words "the parody" on the end and make it a comedy, and suddenly becomes legal.
Yeah, they've even done an Avatar parody 3D.
I know who the stereographer is.
Really?
Yes, and you know what's funny? He's not normally a stereographer, and you know him too, and it's funny because it was his first job as a stereographer, and I think that was the first 3D porn. That was actually like
John Holmes did it.
The original, right. But the new digital.
But you had to wear the glasses.
Be careful when you say something is the first of anything.
I know.
Yeah.
But, no, okay, fine. We'd have to research
John
that.
John Holmes
I'm
did Harry, one of his right. Harry Ball roles as it was a 3D.
It was probably shot on film, though, right?
Right.
Okay, so.
Everything was red and blue, though, so it just didn't look right.
That's anima.
All right.
I just have one quick one.
All the Stewardesses? 1970s films by Norm DePlume.
Oh, right. Norm DePlume. Yeah. Exactly.
Yes. So with the meteor hit in Russia this past week, which was huge, which I don't know if you guys have seen the videos, but as soon as I saw that first dashboard video, immediately I was like, Superman, Red Sun, this is it. This is where we're going.
It looks like something out of a movie.
It does.
It kind of looks like a bad version because it actually looks like it gets bigger, like it's coming at you, like...
And I thought, when I saw it, I was like, oh, it's CG. Like, somebody did this just to hype things up. It wasn't until the next day that I saw Neil deGrasse Tyson tweeted about it. And I was like, oh, there you go, verified. Got it. It's real.
Yeah, it looked like the pilot to Smallville.
It looked exactly like the like that cheesy, like, big bolt thing that just got bigger. You're like, please, it doesn't look like that in real life.
Okay, so I guess this just says to the studios... Think before you really bitch at your artists. It does look real, okay?
Exactly. Well, anyway, so with this this meteor hitting, there is a new meteorite rush, like a gold rush in Russia right now.
Because
the meteorite pieces are so valuable to scientists to find them that people are rushing out to get them, and they're saying that they have them at 40 times the current cost of gold, which is 66,000 rubles, $2,200 per gram, to find these little pieces of meteorite.
Yeah, everyone out there is combing the alt trees and the ground for
exactly. So it's just funny to think that, you know, hundreds of people were hurt in this and so much property damage, and all of a sudden people are like, oh, there's meteorite in them there hills.
grandma come here, I realize this hurts, but we need to extract this, we can buy dinner.
Right.
And I guess the biggest piece is in a lake somewhere.
Yeah, there was a 26 foot crater created in the ice of a lake. So I don't know if they're going to send divers in because the lake is frozen, or if they're going to wait for it to thaw. Or I'm going to guess that there's probably, you know, some farmer out there that just has a makeshift diving bell, and they're just going to get into that.
I'm surprised that big of one actually made it. Most of these things, even though that big, they explode just before they get to the ground, and they still go off like nuclear bombs. Like this.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, the shockwave did most of the damage.
Right. But though, in fact, it's happened in Russia before.
Yeah, in 1908.
People didn't know what happened because it didn't leave a crater. It exploded right above the tree line, knocked every freaking tree down, and, you know, miles and miles and miles, and no one.
Everybody thought it was some paranormal event, and what happened was it was a meteor.
And then years later, when we, you know things, they start pulling pieces off out of trees and stuff of this.
Well, it's just crazy because it's when something like this happens, it shows you how powerful the Earth's atmosphere is. Like when it came in, it says that this thing was 55 feet across and weighed about 10,000 tons.
Yeah.
And this is what when it reached the ground, this is what we got.
It was like a 28, you know, little.
Well, and talk about, you know, life imitating art. They were interviewing some of the eyewitnesses in Russia, and the captions were saying it was just like the movie Armageddon. So the Russians were saying it was like the movie.
Wow.
Yep.
So that's what I got. Yeah, it was pretty cool. And the weird thing is we were all looking a little higher at the asteroid that was passing close.
Exactly. We're on Friday, there's this other thing. Oh, no. Right.
So when people, at work, people were like, hey, you know, this thing came down. They go, no, that's, you guys don't know what you're talking about. That's, you know, later. I didn't realize at the exact same time there was.
It's a lot like Armageddon, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. An asteroid 15 minutes from hitting the Earth. Creepy.
Well, that was Deep Impact. They like exploded it and then it just broke up into smaller pieces. Or was that?
That was Armageddon. Oh, they bore a nuke into the heart of it. Armageddon, there was a lot of science in that movie.
Armageddon, they diverted it. Deep Impact, they split it, but it still hit.
Wiped
out the whole East Coast.
I didn't see Deep Impact. I figured if I was going to see one asteroid movie, that was plenty.
Oh, I always wanted to take those two movies and edit a mashup together.
Ooh, I like that.
Just take the few good parts from both of them and see if I can make one.
Here's
good
the funny
one.
Thing is,
the video is all of 3 minutes long.
I was going to say good part.
I was the first script that I was going to write a long time ago was I wanted to write a remake of When Worlds Collide. I really like that old movie, and I don't think that they brought up things that really could have been brought up. They glossed over some of the really controversial things that happens when the world is going to end.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is great. You know, we haven't had a like disaster movie in like years. So I started writing the script, and then son of a gun, both those movies like were announced
within like 2 weeks of each other or something
I just am gonna stop.
100th Monkey Theory.
Yes.
I was the 100th monkey.
Seen everything 3D has to offer. You haven't seen this. The 3D event of the summer. The most fun you'll have in 3D. In eye-popping 3D. In eye-popping 3D.
In incredible 3D.
In mouth-watering 3D.
Airbending in 3D. Waterbending in 3D. Firebending in 3D.
Digital 3D. In digital 3D. In digital 3D.
In 3D. All right, our topic tonight is 3D, stereoscope, stereo vision.
Yes.
Yes.
What's another term for it?
Binocular stereopsis.
Okay.
Wow.
Stereopsis, yeah. All right. I like that one.
So knowing you guys, I thought, let's get these two in, and let's, these experts, and let's talk about it. And I kind of want to start with kind of making a case for 3D. Because I actually have been doing, I'll tell you straight out right now, that I've been doing a lot of complaining about 3D. And a lot of times if I look at a movie at a, you know, what theater a movie is in, I will sometimes pick one that is not 3D because I've had bad experiences.
I am the same way. So you're talking to a couple of skeptics here. It is very rare that I will go see a movie in 3D on purpose. There's a couple of movies that are out, like Avatar in 3D enhanced the experience. Prometheus in 3D enhanced the experience. And a couple of animated movies, like How to Train Your Dragon. I felt like that was a much better movie experience in 3D. But it's pretty rare that I go to a movie that I'm like, oh, they just put one 3D thing in there just to make us feel better about spending the extra $4. So
there are some people in the room who are on the fence here. So I said, we had a brief conversation in the middle of CES.
Yes, yes.
And then I've talked to you, Shannon, we weren't talking tech. We were talking about why 3D is important to you. And so I wanted to kind of pull that out of you and get that on.
Well, to start, it was very interesting to hear what you just said about seeing a movie and having like one 3D thing in it. What I found is different audience members have completely different concepts of what a 3D movie is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And from what you're saying, I take it that you expect a 3D movie to have things coming off of the screen.
Expect, like Avatar, I loved the 3D because it created so much depth of screen.
Okay.
So it wasn't, I don't want things flying at my face.
Right.
It was, I feel like it enhanced the movie viewing experience because it created this world on the screen that had depth and structure and space.
I have a question for you then.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Does the fact, when you say movie increases your movie experience, are you saying that because it is closer to what your reality is, your world is stereoscopic?
Right.
That you felt like you were able to be engaged in the reality of it because it felt more real, because it looked more like real life? Or do you feel like that there was some there's like an artistic technique?
Exactly. I felt like it was the opposite of that. I felt like because there was an extra layer of artisanship, if that's a word, in the movie, there was a crew that took the time to create an extra experience for me as a moviegoer. Because going to the theater to see a movie now has become an event. You know, it's like, it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to go to the movies for $5 anymore. Like, you have to put down some cash to a flick. So if a movie is going to layer on something extra for me that's going to enhance that artistic experience, that intrigues me.
And right there, I think that's... I'm gonna point out, you just talked about 3D being something that gets layered on. And my argument is that in a good movie that has 3D, the 3D is part of the storytelling. It's not something applied to the movie. It's actually integral to it.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
For instance, let's take Martin Scorsese's Hugo.
Okay.
From day one, Scorsese wanted that to be 3D. Everything was planned to be 3D. Everything was intended to be 3D. And if you see the 2D version of Hugo, you're actually not seeing what Scorsese wanted you to see.
Interesting, because I did see the 2D version of Hugo, and I enjoyed it, but I didn't know what I was missing. Let's put it that way.
It's like a picture of a sculpture.
Okay.
As opposed to seeing something like, let's say when they did Clash of the Titans, and they took something they had in their production pipeline and said, "Oh well, 3D's hot with Avatar. Let's convert this to 3D and put it in theaters."
But this. If you don't mind me saying, this seems almost like the like something you would say as the birth of something new, instead of, like, for example, when rarely these days there's not a decision whether you're going to make a movie color. You don't say, this color would greatly enhance this type of movie. But that's what we normally see. Now, you may tweak it to enhance a mood. You could color correction to change our view
of it. Oh, sure, sure.
But it's not a discussion. It's kind of the opposite now. Like, well, yeah, sure back when they made, you know, Wizard of Oz, they said, now we're going to make a... Now, part of this is going to be color. And the reason is because it's going to tell a story.
Right,
it
right.
feels like in the future that really I would be staring into a window, the screen, and it will be stereo because... That's the way I naturally see things. Isn't that the more kind of advanced way of seeing this?
Well, sort of. But to go back to Scorsese again.
just because you can't use big name directors on your side.
He said something that I found really interesting that I hadn't really considered before. Every time there's been some advancement in cinema, there's been... a bit of a backlash at the introduction of it. When sound was first introduced in the late 1920s, I think it was Jack Warner who said, we don't need sound.
Right.
Throughout the 1950s, the studios felt that color was only applicable to comedies and musicals. Right. If you're doing serious drama, it had to be black and white. Mm-hmm. You couldn't use color. And that didn't change until the late 60s. So, like,
didn't the development of film itself or cinema kind of be like, oh, this is a technology without a future? Wasn't that, didn't somebody say that as well? I'm trying to remember.
I'm sure that somebody
said that. Yeah. The same people that were like, this television thing's never going to take off.
Exactly.
It's just kind of interesting. Well, color television was the same way. Mm-hmm. You know, why would we need that? Mm-hmm. And I think it's sort of, these things are ubiquitous now. Nobody thinks about, oh, I'm going to a color movie. But I remember as a kid, you know, NBC used to have before a show The Peacock, and it would say, the following program is in living color.
Right.
And that was a big deal, that, oh, this show's in color. I think we'll eventually reach a point where we're not going to be promoting it as, oh, this is a 3D movie. Mm-hmm. It'll be, this is a movie. And if the filmmakers chose to make it in 3D, that's how you see it.
See, I am not opposed to 3D at all. The reason why I make choices not to go to 3D movies is because I don't have a good experience in the theater.
I'd love to hear what your bad experience
is. Okay, we'll talk about that a little bit later because I think we'll go in more technical stuff.
Well, no, interesting. It's interesting because it's not necessarily the movie that's the problem. Actually, the weakest link right now is the exhibition. Theaters don't necessarily know how to show good 3D.
Quite sure that is the problem, but there's also an inherent problem with I think the 3D technology now that I don't like, that I don't think is, I think it's just the way where we are in technology.
Yeah.
For example, it is easier when you have a 2D image to your depth of field. What you decide to focus on is something that does not bother me. The cameraman decides what I'm going to look at.
Right, right.
And it doesn't tire me out. It doesn't distract me. Maybe sometimes it does, maybe if you want to see something in the background, but usually it's an artistic choice that works. In 3D, we have a depth of field. But my eyes are now darting around kind of looking at things. My eyes are supposed to focus on the things that I look at. In 3D, my eyes are crossing, and it's trying its damnedest to focus on that stupid floating avatar fairy thing that's out of focus.
Well, here's the thing.
It's in the background.
Okay, first of all, that's a stylistic choice. In the same way that Impressionism is a distinct style in contrast to realism or abstract, whatever. There are different ways, without getting technical, there are different ways to compose and shoot 3D. Some shoot so that everything is in focus, and some shoot so that you actually focus physically the cameras on the point of what we call convergence, which is basically the screen plane. Or
Where your eyes would normally be crossing and looking.
Well, where the point of interest is. So if I want you to be looking at the character who's giving the speech and it's in sort of a medium shot, you could actually have everything in the background out of focus and some stuff in the foreground and out of focus in a or a dirty over-the-shoulder shot in a 2D picture. In a 3D picture, we can do the same sort of thing, and that's a stylistic decision. There's also an argument to if you are the type of storyteller and this is your voice, so to speak, or your style, you can shoot so that everything is in focus and it's much more akin to theater, where, yes, the guy on the stage is giving the monologue, but I can actually decide to look and see what the maid is doing over in the corner if I want to. And that's part of what I really like about 3D, not only the flexibility of the medium to become almost light sculpture, if you would like to look at it that way, but also the ability to not tell your audience exactly where they have to look, to give them the opportunity to walk around in the screen space.
I'm not a fan of that.
But that's a stylistic choice.
Phil McNally, who's the head of global 3D at DreamWorks Animation, likes to explain it as cinema's been around for a little over a century, and cinematographers have spent 100 years becoming really, really good at figuring out how to convert a 3D world into a 2D image.
Right.
And now
Depth
of field being part of that.
A trick.
Depth of field essentially is something that a cinematographer is using to imply the depth that was in the room where they shot. 3D kind of alters the language a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
In that it's still the language of cinema, but it's got, I like to say, it's got a different accent now. Mm-hmm. And what we've been finding is that a lot of the directors of photography who've been working for years in 2D are actually kind of reluctant to change the language, to experiment and see, well, rather than using these long lenses that I use to imply depth, mm-hmm. what happens if I actually use a wider lens, use a shorter lens, move in closer, and frame this to be a 3D shot as opposed to a 2D shot implying 3D.
So do you think that right now that the 3D technology is to the point where everybody can use the tools adeptly? They just need to learn how to do it?
Yeah. The technology has definitely reached a point with digital acquisition and digital exhibition that when it's done right, it can actually be something that, like, for instance, in Avatar, mm-hmm. You don't even think about, oh, I'm watching a 3D movie. You think, oh, I'm watching this world.
Right. Well, I think what the issue that a lot of people have and that Aaron and I have is that there are only a handful of those movies that take the technology and use it correctly. And there are so many more movies that take the technology and don't use it correctly. So I wonder if the issue that a lot of people that don't like 3D now have is that it is that age of cinema where even when movies went to color, that it was like, okay, there were a couple of movies that when they came out, the color was pretty crappy and it looked terrible and didn't do what they wanted to do. They're like, I'd rather have black and white. Well, so do you think it's at the same point?
But I think, I think people focus on the 3D aspect of it. I mean, you want to talk movies in general. There's good movies and there's bad movies. Mm-hmm. There's good 3D movies and there's bad 3D movies.
And I tend to think of it, everybody, it's funny, Aaron, that you would bring up The Wizard of Oz because it's an iconic comparison that almost everybody, whether they're in the industry of 3D or not, starts to discuss when they really start thinking about showing the difference between 2D and 3D and how it comes about and how it changes the language and the culture and using it to tell a story, even where it goes from black and white to color to make you feel like you've left Kansas and now you're in this magical realm. But I like to think of 3D in a different sort of sense, in that, okay, when I was a kid, I loved to make movies and do that kind of stuff. And I had a video camera. It was a lot of fun. And I always say that if I had had YouTube when I was a kid, I would be in a totally different realm right now as a filmmaker, because I would have been able to self-publish. Now, when YouTube first came around, we were in the era of the skateboarding dog, you know, and it was just a bunch of crap. Well, I think that independent and self-published cinema has really allowed for the rise of a lot of really wonderful independent filmmakers who didn't have the ability to get themselves noticed and seen and get their stuff out there, and to be able to experiment and have feedback from the masses rather than just having their friends blow pink smoke, you know, up their nose. But so in the sense of 3D, we're kind of in the era of the skateboarding 3D dog, where, yes, there are some people who are making some really amazing things in 3D, but then there are a lot of people that are kind of splashing around in the shallow end with their water wings on going, look at me. And it's not really, they haven't figured out how to do it yet. And I think that there's this huge push by the studios to really try and exploit this wonderful medium to try and raise ticket prices, drag people back to the box office.
I understand why the theaters are forcing 3D and why TV manufacturers want us to buy 3D, but because they want money.
Of course.
What you two are not getting rich off of these things.
No, not at all.
Why is it that you guys, what is it that you get out of it? Like, for example, if somebody says Fast and the Furious 6 is going to be in 3D, I go, that's a great movie for 3D. Because to me, in my mind, 3D is like, adds this kind of like ride. I'm going on a ride.
Yeah, and it has this. Okay. It has a way of like outlining.
I can tell. Yeah. I can tell that that's exactly what you don't.
Do you
want to
go first or shall I?
No. Okay. Here's the interesting thing. Yeah. To a great extent, a lot of what's come out over the past couple of years with the digital wave of 3D films we've been seeing, there has been a lot of what I call spectacle.
Right.
Absolutely.
There's been. Essentially, if the studio's doing a tentpole picture, they're making it 3D. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we end up with The Amazing Spider-Man and The Avengers and big action movies that happen to have this 3D tacked on as a visual effect.
Right.
What I like to argue is that 3D is actually something really well suited for intimate storytelling.
Okay. Absolutely. This is what I want you to discuss.
3D allows you to make a personal connection with each individual audience member that you can't do in any other medium.
How is that?
You could sit through The English Patient if it was in 3D.
The example I like to cite, have you ever been down to Disney's California Adventure and been to the Muppet Vision Theater?
I have not.
I'd recommend you do it sometime.
Okay.
It's something that was produced for the Disney theme park. I think it was actually the last thing Jim Henson worked on before he passed away.
Okay.
So it's what?
In the 90s, right?
20 years old now, yeah.
Yeah.
And,
or 80s, maybe.
It's a 10-minute attraction, 3D film shot with the Muppets.
Okay.
But there's a moment in it where this character, he's a CG character called Waldo, and he breaks out of the screen and flies into audience space. And there's this really incredible moment where he flies up to your, right up to your nose, and he looks to the left and he looks to the right, then he looks you right in the eye and says, "You know, everyone thinks I'm talking to them, but I'm talking to you." Right? And what's really cool, to think about is you could have 300 people sitting in that room. Every one of them just had a singular experience of that character talking just to them, and That's an obvious, blatant use of making that personal connection with an individual audience member. In a much more subtle way. Take, for instance, Wim Wenders' Pina, which is a really incredible, beautiful film, a documentary about German choreographer Pina Bausch. For some 20 years, Wenders said he wanted to make a film with Pina Bausch. Every time he would shoot her dance performances, he'd take it to a screening room and feel that he was looking at dead footage, mm-hmm. that he was distanced from the performance. And then he saw the U2 concert film that came out, 6 years ago? And
it's longer
had
than
this
now.
Revelation that dance needs to be filmed in 3D to really make that connection to it.
Okay.
So the really sad thing is that Pina Bausch passed away before he could make the documentary. And he shelved the project. But her dance company came to him and said, no, you need to move forward. We want to do this as a tribute. So the film became each member of Pina Bausch's dance company relating what made her so important to them, intercut with performances, dance pieces that they had performed for her or with her that meant something to them. And the connection that you make, they have these portraits of each dancer just looking into camera lens. As you hear a voiceover of what they felt about Pina Bausch, you get such a connection to these dancers, and it just becomes such an emotional thing.
Now, I'm curious about where you... I mean, I get the whole Grover coming out and talking to you thing, but... And I also get the wanting connection. But, you know, I'm wondering how you're feeling that. Like... Ferris Bueller turns the camera and says
he is
looking at every person in the audience.
But here's the difference. And I can explain this probably best with a scene from the U2 film.
Okay.
There's a moment where Bono comes to the foot of the stage and he makes eye contact with the camera and reaches out.
Okay.
If you see that in 2D, you're seeing on screen Bono coming to the foot of the stage and addressing the whole auditorium. When you see that in 3D, you're now the one person that Bono has selected out of the whole audience. And every individual audience member gets that feeling of being the one person making that connection. So you're actually making a one-to-one connection with what's on screen as opposed to the whole room doing it at once. And you don't even get that at the live show. Only the one person Bono actually reaches out to gets that at the live show.
Well, the live show is the worst of all.
Because
the 2D movie, he's looking at you and pointing at you.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But in 3D, you can create a personal connection to each audience member. That Ferris Bueller example. Ferris Bueller's Day Off would be an amazing film in 3D.
We talk about this stuff
Ferris
all the time.
Breaks the fourth wall so much. Because he addresses you directly. And
it sounds like what you're saying is the fact that the person has taken a step toward you in some way makes it more of a... Because literally...
That's simplifying, though.
But if Ferris Bueller turns to the camera and does not step toward you, he looks... He's looking at all the audience.
Okay, here's...
So there must be some type of Z-space thing
it is.
Here
it,
that you're...
Partially, yes. But there's also this whole aspect of the screen doesn't really exist in a 3D movie. The screen becomes a window. And
you're essentially removing the fourth wall is what you're saying.
You're removing the fourth wall completely.
Absolutely. Okay.
What happens is the space behind the screen now becomes a proscenium where everything can happen and things can come through that window into your personal space.
All right. So are we talking what you're saying is that what you're really trying to get to is the holodeck?
Absolutely. I've always said that we geeks in 3D especially, I think are perpetually in search of the holodeck in a way, but it's not just this, it's...
Like, do you feel like this is one step closer to the holodeck, or do you feel like this is something different?
Okay, I always say that 3D is amazing for a couple of reasons. One is that I believe that it can reduce anybody to a five-year-old at a county fair seeing fireworks for the first time. If you hand somebody, one of my favorite things, and Eric can attest to this, is him also, one of my favorite things is my W3 Fuji camera. It's a point-and-shoot 3D camera that is very simple. It does video, 720p. It also does still photography.
This is like affordable by Richard.
Yeah, go on Amazon.
That was actually a question that I wanted to finish your story, but I definitely want to go
absolutely.
Into this.
Absolutely. It's like $200 on Amazon. They have refurb ones that are a little cheaper, maybe $250 before the refurb, $180 after or something like that, but very affordable. And I love to run around and you know, back in the day before I had my 3D camera and I was just a 2D person, I'd go and I'd take pictures of people, or I'd sit in bars and I'd sketch people, or I'd, you know, go home and paint them, or I'd, you know, write little stories about them. But now I take my little 3D camera and I'll take a picture of something really interesting and somebody will start talking to me and they're like, wow, that's a really cool camera. Anyway, eventually you take a picture of them and you're like, oh, it's a 3D camera. And you show it to them. They're like, wow, that's incredible. Now you've got them turned on a little bit. I call it getting them to drink the 3D Kool-Aid. Then you hand them the camera and you say, you take a picture. And strangely enough, they all do pretty much the same progress, which is they take a picture of the space at large and they go, oh, okay. And then they take something close to them, like their beverage or, you know, their foot, that, you know, so they can kind of get some scale. And then they try to do it the long way, like, you know, portrait style. And then they realize that doesn't work. And then they take something that's an actual, like, they try to compose. And they now they're interested and they all want to buy one. And in a
they're starting to recognize foreground, background.
They drink the Kool-Aid. And in a way, it's like they have this reawakening to their own personal human experience. It's not like I'm looking at a movie in which the action is the important thing. I'm now looking at the miracle of blades of grass. I'm now looking at the miracle of trees. And I can see the roundness in clouds and remember how I used to feel when I laid on the grass as a little kid and looked at those clouds and they became things in my mind's eye. And I feel like that same emotional connection happens whether you're talking about a person breaking the fourth wall and looking at you, or if you are just feeling a scene that is a beautiful vista, or somebody that's not even paying attention, looking at an animal or a child, you know, exploring or discovering something, you're almost in reinvigorated with that same sense of awe with actual life. And then when you stop looking at something on a 3D screen or doing some stereoscopic work, you look around life and the world in kind of a renewed sense of appreciation for the depth and the space that you have in front of you. Seriously. And I think, a good example of this is something that nobody's brought up yet tonight, which is Life of Pi. And if you haven't seen it, you need to go see it. It's a whole different... Oh, okay. Well...
I'm actually a bit critical of Life of Pi. I think there are some things that
my reason for saying this is that I think it's a good example of the types of things that you can do to emotionally tug heartstrings. And it sounds manipulative, but hey, you know, everything's a gimmick in film anyway.
That's what every movie is.
So, you know, if you speak to one of my old stereographer friends, Dominique Benicetti, who actually died a year and a half ago, he would say that he hated Spielberg, or he hated the American filmmakers because they used music to manipulate emotional scenes where the scene wasn't that great, but they'd put this music underneath of it and it made you feel so much more. Well, in 3D, we do the same thing, because in Life of Pi is a good example, because there are moments where we actually manipulate the actual depth and compression of space to make you feel vulnerable or lonely or claustrophobic or more frightened, or as if one character has a full, rich life and the other character is lacking something. And we do that by manipulating the way that we compose and compress the space without getting technical.
Right. Well, I'm intrigued by the idea of 3D as an intimate device. Like, this interests me a lot.
One of the best examples, and it's actually something that's really difficult to see, if you ever have an opportunity to see... a film called Inferno from 1953. Mm-hmm. It stars Robert Ryan, Rhonda Fleming. It was produced by 20th Century Fox and was part of the wave of 3D films between 1952 and 1954. There were just over 50 films made during that period.
Maybe.
And Inferno is one of the best that rarely gets to be seen in 3D, if at all. Basically, it's sort of a film noir. The premise is that Rhonda Fleming is married to Robert Ryan, but she's having an affair with her horse riding instructor. So when Robert Ryan gets thrown from his horse out in the desert and breaks his leg, they decide, well, if we just leave him there, it's not like we're actually killing him.
Mm.
So they leave Robert Ryan in the desert to die.
Right.
What they don't expect is that Robert Ryan's survival skills kick in and he figures out how to splint his leg and actually try to make his way back to civilization. What's really cool is all of the Robert Ryan scenes out in the desert, the dialogue is all his inner monologue. It's all his thoughts as he's trying to figure out how he's going to exact his revenge. The shots of Robert Ryan out in the desert are amazing because you get these vast desert vistas that go off to infinity and all at once also make you feel so claustrophobic because you're trapped out there with him. Just him and his thoughts.
See, that's so like that sort of stuff intrigues me. Absolutely.
Brilliant film. Brilliant film. And it actually just ran in San Francisco at the Noir City Film Festival, and I was up there for that and helped them show it. So there may be some more opportunities. 20th Century Fox hopefully is going to make it available. I'd love to see it come out in home video. I think one of the big problems is that there are a lot of people now trying to sort of reinvent the wheel. In the 1950s, they made these 50-something films and sorted out a lot of how the language works. But because those films aren't available for people to watch right now, they're starting from scratch and trying to figure out right from the beginning what works and what doesn't work. Without having that point of reference of what's already been done.
What do you think, like, why do you think it didn't kick in? Like, you know, we had the 80s tried it, the Ice Pirates.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, you know, it's funny.
Digital technology.
That movie is aces.
There are so many misconceptions about 3D, the first of which is that in the 1950s, they were using polarized glasses in theaters.
They were?
Mm-hmm.
Red and blue anaglyph is a printing process. Red and blue anaglyph is used for comic books, for photographs, for something printed on paper, because the only way in a printed image to have two separate images, and just to explain briefly how 3D works for anyone doesn't know.
Did they convert it that when I was like watching it on TV? Remember seeing The Mask?
Well, essentially, here's
the way
that 3D works. Our eyes, we have two eyes. You know, everyone's got two eyes. And they're set about 2.5 inches apart. So they see two slightly different views of the world. You know, if you close your left eye and then
You put your finger out in front of your face.
And you can see the...
Camera one, camera two.
Exactly.
Yeah, camera one, camera two, exactly. And we learn stereopsis between birth and age 5 or 6. We actually learn how to see the world in 3D. It's not something that we're born innately having.
It's your brain.
It's your brain learning,
constructing a math.
Exactly.
To put it together.
Yeah, it's matching
how
the images.
To take those two images and fuse them together into something that only exists in your head.
Right.
A baby reaching out and looking at its hand is learning how depth works.
It's really interesting. They actually say that part of the problem that is people having worse eyesight and more of a problem with stereopsis. There's this wonderful professor that I've been friends with recently, and they're saying that the problem is there's like all of this fear about kids like dying of crib death and all this stuff. So they're padding them up so that they aren't able to actually like lay and
grab and touch,
look, and also they can't look and see and explore things that are close up to them. They can't develop that visual focus.
Well, I was talking to an ophthalmologist, an eye surgeon, who had some very interesting insights. He was saying that one of the things he's found is that students, because they're not working with actual parts anymore, they do all their dissections and whatever on computer screens. They're working on flat screens. So he said kids growing up looking at flat screens is actually causing people to have
weaker
ocular muscles.
Right.
Interesting.
And that's something I like to point out, that watching 3D is basically your two eyes working together. And there's, I forget how many muscles on each eye, but it's a muscle process. And the first time you see a 3D movie, you're working muscles that maybe you're not used to working. So some people do get eye strain the first time they see it. The more 3D you watch, the stronger your eye muscles get.
It's just like working out, folks. Yeah, it hurts, yeah. But like, you know.
Part of that is that those filmmakers have got those, your 2.5 inches is stretched to 5 inches and everything's
all... Well, that's a whole different ball of wax. No, that's a whole different ball of wax. Hold on.
Yeah.
That's... Roger Ebert would have you believe that there's a problem with disconnecting your accommodation from your vergence. That's where your eyes converge from where they focus. And, you know, we're much more plastic than...
Absolutely.
Than that. Now, yeah, but you I know teach, I, well no. that sometimes you go, ooh.
Well,
when
sure,
when
but
stupid
let me just,
gets all...
Let me just say that I, sure, I teach Camp Red every summer, which is a summer camp that Red Studios puts on, and they have a 3D portion, and I teach the 3D portion of Camp Red every year. I will tell you, those little buggers, they want what we call throw-up 3D. You can max their little eyeballs out, and it's like diverging like crazy, and you're just going... You're not supposed to be able... Your eyes aren't supposed to do that. And, I mean, eventually, well, they... You know, you get older and you're not quite as elastic. But you would be surprised how strong your eyes can become.
So, yeah, and I mean, I do agree that there is an issue with, you know, throwing things at the audience.
Absolutely.
They push the limit.
Oh, absolutely.
But that's something
just from what both of you guys have said so far, I would actually be more interested in the smaller scale versions of what 3D can,
so
what can be done with 3D.
Fast and Furious 6 would be less interesting.
Not Fast and Furious 6. Well, but like what you were saying with the ballet documentary.
Yes.
Every time, every once in a while, the Met will set up cameras and do a live broadcast.
Oh, yeah.
In theaters.
And
now, that, just from hearing you talk, I would think it's like, in 3D?
They do that.
I would highly recommend, if you ever have an opportunity, 2 years ago, they released theatrically a 3D live performance of the opera Carmen, and it was just amazing because you're on stage.
I can imagine it was breathtaking because, like you said, it was like the screen becomes a proscenium,
exactly,
and everyone else you see the depth.
I come from music theater land as a background, and my entire life I've been trying to make film, but I refuse to try and make it on a cinematic sense, and I've always found that a lot of my 2D was really boring, and then eventually I discovered 3D and I was like, oh my gosh, all the things I've been trying to do all this time actually work because I have a Z-plane. You know,
the example I like to throw out as sort of how you can think of this in storytelling terms, just imagine you're telling the story of Adam and Eve and the temptation of the serpent and everything, and you have an apple sitting on the corner of the table. Okay, in a 2D movie, you frame the shot, you have the apple, maybe you rack focus to show the apples there. In a 3D movie, you can actually frame it so that the apple just ever so slightly comes off screen into audience space. And now, because of that intimate connection that each individual audience member has, that apple...
Everyone's being tempted.
The apple now becomes the source of individual temptation. Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right, so how does a normal person get a good experience? I've been to the ArcLight. By the way, do not see a 3D movie on the curved screen.
No, at the dome, it's terrible.
No. And actually, I would suggest not seeing it at the ArcLight at all.
Okay. So what are we? What should we be looking at?
As much as I love the ArcLight,
I'm addicted to it.
It's blocks from my house. Think of how it is for me. It sucks. I can't go there because I don't go to the flatties.
So what
sadly, and I apologize, ArcLight, because I do enjoy going there. Sadly, they don't have the best 3D presentation in town.
Okay. So how do we find out? Is there some type of stamp? Is there a THX stamp that we can look for 3D?
But you have to have the glasses to see it.
Probably the two best venues for seeing 3D would either be a digital IMAX screen.
Okay.
A digital IMAX screen. not to get too technical about it, there's a number of different ways that 3D is being presented. Mm-hmm. At the ArcLight, they're doing what's called active 3D,
where they give glasses,
you, they give you electronic glasses. They have a single projector that's alternating between left eye and right eye images, and the glasses are shuttering left eye and right eye to match.
They're heavy and they
don't fit.
If you wear glasses, they don't fit over them.
I went to a movie with a four-year-old, and he was like, this is terrible. I can't handle this.
And, they run down. They're not charged up correctly. It's horrible.
There are some issues with those. Now, you'll probably see, if you look at the ads, a lot of theaters have what they call Real-D 3D. Okay. Real-D is a company that manufactures a projection system that basically uses circular polarized glasses. So you've got glasses where the lenses are filters. They're polarizing filters.
So this is kind of like the old school ones.
Yeah, similar.
But instead of red and blue, you've got spinning
the old
to the
polarized, like from the 80s.
Right. So essentially there's two different kinds of polarizing filters. There's linear polarizers and there's circular polarizers. Linear polarizers just have an angle and let through all of the waves that are aligned with that angle. So typically, in fact, if you go to a digital IMAX theater, they're using linear polarizers.
Right.
If you go to a Real-D theater, they're using circular polarizers, which either have a clockwise or a counterclockwise orientation.
Okay.
So the upshot of that is that if you go to an IMAX movie, don't tilt your head to one side or another, because then the 3D stops working.
Yeah.
Because either the light molecules that are going up and down get through your left eye, and the ones going side to side go through the right eye. And so if you tilt your head, now everything's blocked. Mm-hmm. And so you'd see two images.
But isn't that too complicated? Isn't that like somebody just wants to go to a movie and now they're like, you have to hold your head.
It's more forgiving than that.
Just don't lay down on the couch.
People tend to figure that out pretty quickly.
Right. Uh-huh. But
this is real 3D.
Real D has two different systems. Mm-hmm. They have one system that uses a single projector and an electronic polarizing panel that alternates between clockwise and counterclockwise.
Okay.
That matches either the left filter or the right filter in your glasses. So they're alternating left, right, left, right, left, right, like the shutter glasses do.
Right.
But the shutter's actually on the projector rather than on your face.
Okay.
Okay.
Which is great, because instead of completely obscuring your point of view on one eye or the other, which often give people headaches because we don't see by blinking our eyes alternately, it actually allows you to see normally and you don't aren't
like
conscious.
Kind of the same thing.
But you're not conscious of the change in which light is being hitting your eye, because light takes time to travel, and
it actually depends to a great extent on how the theater's operating. What they typically is they do what's called triple flashing.
Oh, right.
Where the movie's running at 24 frames per second, but they're actually running it at 144, so that it flashes left, right so fast that you don't perceive the flashing, which has actually become a problem with high frame rate. Because at high frame rate, they can't get the current projectors to triple flash.
Right.
So at the lower flash rates, you do actually see some anomalies on screen. Mm-hmm. Which is why I tend to recommend either the digital IMAX, which uses two projectors, one for left, one for right.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And project simultaneously. Or if you know that a theater is using a Sony 4K projector with the Real-D system...
And there is a list of those theaters throughout North America Stereo Sisters Tumblr feed. That's Stereo Sisters 3D / Tumblr.
Yeah, so you can find, and actually the theaters with the Sony 4K projector.
Whatever Tumblr.
What they do is they actually project left and right simultaneously, one above the other, and have two polarizers and two lenses on the projector. So they're projecting two 2K images out of the 4K projector. At the same time.
And now, is that a company that would have a logo on any newspaper or?
Yeah. If the theaters always put Real-D.
I've definitely seen the Real-D 3D. Yeah. Okay. That's familiar.
So if you're going to go to a theater and it says Real-D, you may just want to confirm that you're going to see it on a Sony 4K screen.
Okay. That could just be a phone call away.
Absolutely.
But chances are, if you choose simply to go with a real deep projection or some kind of polarized filtering, we call them passive glasses solution, as opposed to going in, if you see the big heavy glasses or it doesn't, you know, say real D, just try to find another theater that does have passive as opposed to active glasses. Right. That'll
There's other systems out there too. Master Image has a system that uses a spinning polarizer in front
Dolby
of the
projector. Has a system, Dolby which has is a system. Color wheel system, and they have different glass sort of glasses. And
those are all passive?
Yes.
Yeah.
They don't have any moving parts.
By the way, there are now passive TVs.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's new, because before they didn't have a way of getting it polarized light to you.
So right. A number of companies, LG and Vizio, they've got
Lenovo.
TVs out that actually have a micro polarizing film over the screen, so that every other line of resolution is polarized in an opposite direction.
That's how they do it.
That's how they do it.
It's like ventricular.
It's
polarized.
It's not quite a lenticular. Just imagine like all the odd lines on the screen are polarized one way and all the even lines on the screen are polarized.
It's kind of like those things that you when you make an accordion fan out of a piece of paper when you were a kid.
Mm-hmm. And you could see
half the picture.
Well, that's
kind of like
that. Does that mean you're getting a half resolution image on
those? On the passive TVs, you're getting half resolution to each eye. But the interesting thing is it's half resolution in the left, half resolution in the right, but they're two different images, and when you fuse them together, you don't really perceive that. Because your brain's putting together a full resolution image.
Right.
And this is largely, though, why they suggest that 4K TV will actually make 3D TV more desirable, but I don't know.
TV. I have to say, I laughed. I went to CES.
Yes.
In which it was all about 4K. Last 2 years...
that was the thing.
More than 3D. Like, last couple of years, it's been 3D, 3D, 3D. Yeah. They backed off on 3D.
They didn't back off on it.
Oh, come
everyone's...
On.
Every, no,
they're
no,
just, they're
no,
just
here's
terming
the thing.
It differently?
3D is now just a feature.
Okay. They backed off on the signs, the ads. There were 3D TVs
exactly.
There. It used to be, literally, you'd go...
We're not Datsun anymore. We're Hyundai.
Well, everybody had it. Like, you'd go into the audio thing, and they'd have 3D audio. And you're like, come on, just give me a break. I mean, and that was backed off.
But right.
They had 4K TVs, which at first I laughed at, because I'm like, listen, most people can't even tell the difference between their standard def and high def.
Yeah.
I have to say... Those LG like 3D TVs that were 4K were
they're stunning.
I, you know, being a kind of a 3D, you know, wishy-washy, I walked in there with these light flimsy glasses, which essentially they were giving away. They were so cheap.
Oh, really?
These TVs were like freaking unbelievable.
Huh.
They looked really good. It was the first time I was like, man, I would buy a 3D TV if I was getting that.
Yeah, well, that sort of stuff intrigues me.
The glasses, you could barely even feel them on.
Right.
You just, you know.
Well, but along with the technology, as you were saying, with the 3D camera that you just have that you use. Yeah. So just to explain the technology a little bit. So when you take a 3D picture and you look at it, it exists in 3D on your camera, and obviously would exist in 3D if you transferred it to a computer.
Here's the thing. You have two eyes. The two eyes see two discrete images. Those two discrete images go into your brain and become one image. The same thing is true on a camera. You take two discrete images, and then when you take the images out of the brain of the camera or whatever display device you have that knows how to interpolate 3D, and you just put it like on a piece of paper, it would be two discrete images.
Okay.
You have to figure out how to deliver the left eye image to only the left eye and the right eye image only to the right eye. So we do that in a various mode, different modes of delivery.
And right
one
now that's a little bit of a problem.
Well, one is anaglyph that we're all familiar with, which is the red and the blue, and it uses a filter that gets rid of red or gets rid of blue in the opposite eye. Then there is the polarizing filters that we were just discussing. There's active glasses, which basically blink one eye or the other multiple times. And then there's the whole auto stereoscopic thing, which is basically taking the filtering lenses off your eyes and putting it on the screen. So
Nintendo's DS.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, which is basically creating a barrier on the screen so that when you hold it at the right angle, your right eye half of the vertical lines on the screen are blocked to your right eye, the other half of the vertical lines on the screen are blocked to your left eye. And it's like the old lenticular pictures.
Right.
But the idea is a lot of people ask, well, why can't we do that on a large scale? Because the point is on a personal device, you can personally hold that device and get it to where you're in the sweet spot and where it works for you. If I have a larger screen, if I am only one person and I'm sitting in front of this one screen, well, sure, that's not a problem. But we don't usually operate in a vacuum. We don't watch TV that's 52 inches or whatever by ourselves. You have to have multiple points of view. So every time that we have a unique point of view, you have to have another pair of images that...
What they need to do is have like an Xbox Kinect that looks is looking for faces.
Yeah, well, actually, that's called retinal tracking, and they have that.
Does work. I've seen that on an autostereoscopic laptop where it used the webcam to reposition the barrier.
And isn't that what...
To reposition the lenticular
thing. No, I've seen that on a 3D laptop where it repositioned.
Isn't that what Apple's patents are based on from rumor?
I don't know about that. Master Image has a system.
Is that what Master Image does? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So personally adjusting it.
But it's still a single user.
Right.
Okay, so is maybe that's the disconnect, is that you have this amazing device that can take pictures and can take video, but say an independent filmmaker wants to make a 3D movie, and so they shoot a 3D movie on their, you know, 3D camera.
There are
do they need a 3D computer
to edit that?
I would suggest that you do your post production and have some way to look at your 3D while you're doing it, but the computer itself doesn't have to be any different.
It has to be able to do heavy lifting. It can't be something.
I'm just asking because, like I said, I was intrigued by the idea of like intimate 3D putting it down on a smaller scale. Do we have the technology in which an independent filmmaker could say,
yes,
I'm going to make a 3D movie. I don't have $100 million.
You know,
you're YouTube, looking at two of them.
You know, YouTube has a 3D player, has for the past 4 years. Yeah.
I did not know that.
There's a little 3D button on the bottom that you can activate if you set it up right.
Yeah,
if you upload
a 3D movie to YouTube and set the metadata, then when it streams to your computer, the player sees the 3D metadata and opens up a little 3D menu for you.
Interesting.
And then depending on what kind of display you have it connected to, if you happen to have a 3D laptop, you can select... that you have an autostereoscopic display, or you can select that you have a passive polarized. Yeah, it's got a menu for that.
It pukes in 31 flavors. You just got to know what flavor you want.
If you happen to have some anaglyph glasses, you can select whether you've got red blue glasses. You can select if you have cyan magenta glasses.
Or green, purple, whatever you have. We are in a stage, though. It is a little difficult to absorb the content right now.
It is.
That's what I'm saying. Is that like a way to make it easier?
That are coming out. And there's one right
here. Autostereoscopic tablet. Got it this weekend.
It's
right?
I think the cool thing though is that you know, you mentioned that they've moved on to 4K, but just about every TV on the show floor still had 3D as a feature.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean,
I can
burn a 3D Blu-ray, and I can put that Blu-ray into my PS3, and I can watch it on my 3D TV.
Right, but to be fair, and I'm sure it will get better. If the people who buy high def TVs, you know, like half the people don't even hook up the high def because they don't even know how to do that. It's not about the TV. It's about getting your 3D camera, knowing that it's two images, putting it into iPhoto, does it know what 3D is? Because that's what I use in my Mac.
Yeah,
iPhoto.
Making it user-friendly.
Okay, now I need to get it to my 3D TV, and what do I put it on? You know what? It is, at this point, it is not as easy as...
It's a learning curve. It is. There are growing pains, but it's becoming so much easier. I mean, Eric's been doing the 3D way longer than I have, but I would say that I ramped up pretty fast, considering all things. I came from a theater background, so instinctively I kind of understood once they gave me the toy. I kind of went, oh, I totally get this. Yeah, perfect. But I also do a lot of educational outreach with 3D. I teach kids 3D. I have this women's group where it's all about educational outreach for women and girls, trying to get them into the STEM disciplines, science, technology, engineering, math. And I think that it really has... once you get the basic premise, it's really pretty simple to understand that you need your basic components, which is your two eyes to acquire, and then you need to do your regular editing, however it is you're going to do that. And I mean, yes, there are some caveats and some rules, and you start, just like anything else though, like skateboarding, you learn what works and what doesn't, because it hurts if it doesn't work. And then eventually you get done with your product and you learn that you now need to put it onto some way to deliver it. And there are increasingly every day new ways to deliver that to content to a viewer. There are 3D laptops, there are 3D TVs, there are 3D computer monitors,
every kid with a Nintendo 3DS has a personal 3D
screen. Can we transition to like the future, like especially focus on the user, like consumer, like consuming the product more than making?
I do think that what has been lacking has been any kind of initiative to actually educate the public as to how 3D works and how they can experience it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a personal mission, but gosh, not everybody does it.
the first question people always ask me when I tell them I do 3D is, well, why do I have to wear the glasses?
Right.
And...
because they're so fashionable.
Don't even start with me on that. I had a 3D glasses fashion show last year.
Well, I have 3D clip-ons.
I like that you just carry them.
But, you know,
we all do.
I like that you have
we all do.
I take my own to the theater.
There are like, at this time, over 50 3D glasses manufacturers on the planet. And I'm talking, you can get them in every flavor.
Yeah, actually, all of the major companies that manufacture sunglasses are also manufacturing 3D glasses in all kinds of styles. If the public knew they were out there and that they could have a really cool looking pair of 3D glasses that they could take to the theater themselves.
I personally believe that, you know, that someone shouldn't really have to ask why we are wearing glasses. That this is really not going to catch on until you can sit down on the couch without your glasses.
Well, you know, exactly. Can you do that, Aaron?
Do they make exactly.
a... Can you sit down on the couch and watch a movie without your glasses?
Hold on. But I wish I could.
Hold on. The point is true, though.
I mean, you have to wear glasses to correct your vision. I understand.
Do you ever complain that, you know, for Apple says, in order to listen to music, you have to put speakers in your ears?
If I'm going to go outside and I'm going to enjoy, you know, seeing this football game outside and it's bright and sunny, you mean I have to put sunglasses or some kind of glasses on my face so that I...
Because those are very specific...
So is this.
Yeah, I don't have to put in earbuds into my ears. I can just play it with my speakers. I decide if I want a personal experience, I can do that.
So I don't see how it's different.
It's completely different.
If you want a personal experience.
To absorb the 3D without this.
If you're driving down PCH on a beautiful summer day with the top down, sun's out over the ocean, do you put on glasses to make the experience better?
I get where you're coming from. I'm just saying that
if somebody doesn't want to put on the glasses, they can very easily select... I'll just watch the 2D version.
Right.
Additionally, I mean, let's go back to the whole idea of glasses. Wait a minute. Seriously, why do people wear sunglasses? They don't always just wear them to protect against the sun. They wear them because they're fashionable. Come on, we're all into fashion. And that goes literally back to the idea.
Is the technology coming where we don't have to wear it? Because eventually, I can play my Nintendo without it.
Yeah. Yes.
So eventually, why do I have to sit in the theater?
Eventually there will be. Here's the issue. An auto stereoscopic screen...
we just kind of went over it.
...is... much more of a single user thing currently.
Right.
The technology's not really there yet for a multi-user experience glasses free.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, sure. I mean, you know, there's advances
every
being
year
made. There's advances being made in holographic projection. There's advances being made in...
But every year when you go see those 3D or those glasses-less TVs, there's three footprints on the floor where you can stand instead of
like
one.
Stand here and watch your television.
I mean, literally, like three, 4 years ago, we went and there was these demo screens at CES.
Yeah.
And there's a little spray painted footprint on the ground where you had to stand right there to see it. And you went, holy crap.
That's amazing.
3D. And then you took one step
to the side.
And then the next year, they had two foot footprint. Right.
Well, and this, this goes back to the point of view, as we were talking about. Every time you have a different user sitting down and watching the same screen, you have to generate a distinct pair of points of view for each user.
Let's put it this way. Here's what it comes down to. On a larger audio stereoscopic screen, you need more than just a left and a right. Typically, those screens where you've got multiple footprints that you can stand in, mm-hmm. they're generating maybe 8 or 9 views between
and
the left view and the right view.
And that's somewhere between 16 and 18 pairs, of eyes. So, right.
Okay.
There was an experimental screen that was exhibited at, I think it was at NAB last year.
Yep, we saw it together.
It was like a 200-inch screen that required some 250 HD projectors behind it.
In order to
have enough images to be able to have a crowd standing around looking at
us. Everybody was getting these.
Everybody was
so in other words, it was just really cost-effective.
Yeah.
I mean, it was an experiment by the Chinese government is what it was.
It can't be done. It's that...
What else were they feeding in?
We're still a good decade away from technology that makes it practical.
Really?
Well,
That being said,
I like to think about this. Okay, so years ago we had, film projection, then we went to digital projection. In the same way that you think about, okay, we had regular TV and then we had digital TV. And then we went from digital TV to HD TV. Mm-hmm. And then we went from regular projection that was HD or whatever to all of a sudden there was 2K. Ooh, and that didn't happen very long ago. Well, it took us quite a while to transition from regular TV to HD TV, like what, 5, 7, maybe 10 years to actually really transition, get everybody up to broadcasting in that format and all that kind of stuff. Not too long after we got to the point of HDTV, we got to the point of 2K projection. Within a year of going from getting 2K projection in a theater, we had a 2K TV set. And then in a few months of that, we ended up getting a 4K projector. Within 6 months of that, we had a 4K television screen.
So you think we're going to get that technology sooner?
I would not be surprised if it suddenly made a leap that was unexpected.
I was just at the Stereoscopic Displays and Applications Conference in San Francisco, and we're still a good decade out.
Well, that's assuming
that sucks because I think
that we don't have some mass genius somewhere.
I think the argument that Aaron's making is that with most technologies, you have to dummy-proof it.
You have
to make it whatever the lowest common denominator is.
Having a consumer TV that you put on your wall that everyone sits around and sees Princess Leia standing in the room. We're still a ways off from.
And you know what? The fact that, one of the coolest things that I saw at CES is that that things like Netflix is going to bring that type of content to...
Which is cool.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
that's great.
Yeah. Netflix is going to help us.
Is starting to stream 3D content
right
now.
Which makes it even for dumber proof. Like, you don't have to...
Absolutely.
Search for it. It's going to be there.
Well, and what they've done, I mean, the current standards, the way these 3D TVs work, they read the metadata that's in the file. So when a 3D file hits the TV switches into 3D
Kicks
mode.
In.
And it gives you manual options. You can turn it on, you can turn it off if you want to. But they've tried to make it pretty idiot-proof.
I think that the really cool thing that is going to change it, and it kind of goes hand in hand with what Eric was saying about it being an intimate experience and a personal experience, is that right now everybody is looking for the glasses-free experience. And an intimate experience is really what's going to sell 3D overall. I mean, there are wonderful educational benefits. There's, 40 to 60% retention rate increase if you show somebody content in 2D or 3D as opposed to 2D. So my thought is this has really got a great impact when we're talking educationally. And you can't have a bunch of little 2-year-olds laying around with circular polarized glasses and grubby fingers and expect them to be able to, learn in that sort of increased way.
That little tablet thing would work.
Exactly. And who is it that's coming out next year with a kid-proof auto-stereoscopic tablet. Somebody was telling me about that. Okay, somebody told me about this.
Play it's school, a rugged leapfrog.
It's a ruggedized auto-stereoscopic screen tablet. And in my mind, that is what's really going to change the face of 3D. That is the future of 3D, because not only are you got a whole new generation that are going to grow up with the really cool animated movies that we know work really well in 3D and are some of the best content overall that the modern digital 3D movement has mm-hmm. been able to produce thus far, as far as quantity and reliability. Animated features are usually doing the best jobs across the board. So once you can start doing that with educational programming and giving a child their own personal, interactive, intimate experience with that technology and with that story, you know, add a little choose your own adventure, add a little, you know, I choose, I learn kind of stuff going on. Suddenly, kids are going to grow up and they're going to go, why isn't it in 3D?
See, and that's exciting. Like, that sort of technology is exciting, and I think that stuff like that will help 3D sort of break through whatever the glass ceiling is on it now.
Yeah, the glasses ceiling.
You asked me a question earlier about the 1950s and why it only lasted 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because, you know, I mentioned there were misconceptions about what kind of glasses were used then. Mm-hmm. There's also a misconception that it died out because people got headaches, people didn't want to wear the glasses, mm-hmm. and all of that. 3D actually died out in 1954 because the studios had a decision to make. Did they want to put their money into 3D or did they want to put their money into CinemaScope and widescreen? Mm. And ultimately, the cost of sending 2 35-millimeter prints to every theater proved right. too high mm-hmm. when you could send one widescreen print to every theater. Mm-hmm. And that's what killed 3D in 1954. It was entirely financial. And, okay, the 1980s had some real crap.
Ice Pirates is one of my favorite ones.
Of course.
Jaws 3D. It's like
gone the way of Betamax and HD DVDs.
But
Laserdiscs.
One thing to really watch for is what are the box office numbers this year from Sam Raimi's Oz. Mm-hmm. Going back to The Wizard of Oz, let's see how he uses 3D the way that The Wizard of Oz used color.
I wonder if he'll go from 2D to 3D.
I'm curious as to whether they do that. I'm also curious from what they've shown in their trailers. Kansas is black and white.
Yes, and they're square. Doing that.
Oh, God.
Oh, really? And they're going to expand it.
And it opens up when he gets...
See, now that's
interesting.
Brilliant.
Interesting. Yeah.
So I'm curious to see how Raimi, because you know, Raimi is such an incredible visual guy. I'm really curious to see how, given this new tool, how he plays with it.
Well,
And along the same lines, when The Great Gatsby comes out later this year, Baz Luhrmann directed this. Mm-hmm. Talk about a visual director.
Eye candy.
You know, this is a guy who comes out of opera and ballroom dancing.
Right.
So, I think telling F. Scott Fitzgerald's story using 3D and Baz Luhrmann's sensibilities is going to be a really remarkable thing to see.
That light at the end of the dock is going to come really intriguing.
All right, let's wrap this up. Anything we want to say before we...
Well, I learned a lot. Thank you guys. Very informative.
I'm reinvigorated. I'm going to search for correct theaters so I don't get frustrated.
Right, right.
The last two movies, I had to go back and exchange my glasses because they never would sync. Luckily, I know that was the problem and I didn't sit there for 2 hours.
Yeah.
Because I actually know...
Being frustrated.
Yeah, we kind of said it very... at the beginning of this, there is an issue with exhibition. I've actually been to quite a few theaters where I've had to go and complain because they weren't showing it properly.
Mm-hmm. Almost every time I go to the theater, and I try to go to see 3D movies with their stereographers because I'm blessed enough to actually know most of them. It's a pretty small community.
They must actually die when something's not working.
It
right.
is, must be so
I went to the re-release of Avatar with Chuck Comiskey, who was the 3D guy for that, and he... was, you know, he's been with James Cameron the entire time since the beginning of all of his 3D experiments and was lovingly referred to as Golden Eyes by James Cameron, actually. And we went to go see the re-release of Avatar at Universal City IMAX, and they actually showed it on film prints. And the disc or the shuttle to actually play two 65 millimeter prints is enormous. And there's not only gate weave, there's wobble, there's all kinds of stuff. Chuck was horrified. This happens to me every time I go to the theater. If it's not shown right, we got to stop, or we got to wait at the end of the theater, and we got to go talk to the manager and the projectionist. And then we get into discussion about why it's wrong.
I went to went to see Harold and Kumar's Christmas at a theater in Las Vegas, and buying my ticket, the girl at the ticket counter said, "Now, you know that's in 3D. You sure you want to see it?"
Wow. Really?
Smack her.
And, well, the interesting thing was I got into the theater and the trailers start running, 3D trailers, and they've cropped off like a quarter of the screen.
Right.
And I went back and looked into the port, into the projection booth, and I could see that their equipment wasn't even in place properly. So trying to find the 17-year-old kid with the walkie-talkie, that's the big problem at theaters right now. That
I just work here, sir.
Exactly,
sir,
exactly.
I don't know what you're talking about.
But when it's done properly, when it's done well,
it's magic.
It can actually, it's I think it is a sufficiently advanced technology that's indistinguishable from magic, if I can quote Arthur C. Clarke.
Mm.
It's closer to time travel.
You're pandering to our geek crowd.
Of course.
It's closer to time travel in a way. I really believe it because it's not really
possible. I mean, we can get into that, but
it's not just capturing a moment. Being there.
Yes. If you actually take a look at, like, we, you know, I was saying, it's ultimately for the studios, it comes down to what are the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you look at the box office for 3D pictures, look at the list of, you know, what the highest grossing films are. They're 3D.
Oh no, they're doing very well.
Yeah,
and take a look at for instance, what's getting award nominations. You know,
thank you.
Last year, we had Hugo, we had Pina. This year, Life of Pi, and if I can toot my own horn, Maggie Simpson in The Longest Daycare.
Congratulations.
That got a nomination. So when it's done artistically, it gets recognized as a piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, if we can get this tool into the hands of creative people who want to figure out how they can experiment and play with this to tell their stories, we're going to see some really remarkable work.
I'm still going to see Fast and the Furious 6 in 3D, though.
I am not.
Cars flying at you.
I'm just not going to see the movie.
All right, we're going to close this down. I have a little quiz here before we end the show. It's multiple choice. You can each pick the answer that you think is correct. It's only like
five.
You
don't get a buzzer?
No buzzer.
God.
But these are just
hop
things
on the
I picked out in the like news that are
so
just weird.
Do we just shout out the answer if we know?
I'll just go one at a time. You guys can pick A, B, or C.
Okay.
If you want to pick the same one, you can. But all right. This is kind of the geek news crazy quiz. In the "What the hell are those scientists thinking" category, which one of these things do you think is true? Only one of them is true. That a leading Harvard geneticist believes that his Neanderthal bone sampling analysis is now complete and, quote, "now I need an adventurous female human." Or B, military scientists programming drones to smell human blood using advanced chemical sensors. Or C, robotic engineers apply for federal funded research grants to study female sexual techniques and how they can be applied to robots, quote, "taking one more step in becoming more human than human." So A, geneticist just needs a woman to complete a Neanderthal baby. B, military scientists putting chemical sensors on drones to smell blood. Or C, robotic engineers trying to get government funding.
Makes me think of that old commercial. It's my girl robot.
What do you think,
Bruce? Well, I'm pretty sure A is the correct response, but I wouldn't be surprised if C was in the works.
Okay.
Knowing the porn industry.
I was hoping for an answer that involved human animal hybrids in Pig Boy, but
that's real.
Yeah, his name is Dale.
You know, I'll go with the drones that can smell human blood.
Okay. That would be a what were they thinking category.
Oh, boy. They all just sound so plausible given our nutsy world. You know, it's really not beyond me to think that behavioral scientists would want to know what stimulus and synapses and all that good stuff do. So I'm going to go with C.
Well, all right. One of each category. Brad, you are right.
All right.
Hey, Harvard geneticist, all he needs is an adventurous female to complete the embryo. I cannot say this. Neanderthal fetus.
You think about that and you wonder, it's like, will it be like The Fly where what is going to come out of me?
This is just a bad idea.
So they're not making zombie drones then?
No zombie drones.
Okay.
That actually is slightly based on something I heard years ago where they were trying to develop robots to recharge batteries based off of human blood so they could search for carcasses in the field. And I'm like, have they even seen a science fiction
movie? I know.
Movie?
It's like, hey, let's make robots that like blood.
Right.
They win by getting blood. Okay. Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, here's another one. A software developer was fired after he was discovered doing what? A, playing almost 40 hours of World of Warcraft a week for the last 3 years of employment, or B, installing encrypted passwords in all the computers and withholding the password until the employer moved his parking space closer to the entrance, or C, he outsourced his entire job to programmers in China for 20% of what he was being paid. Shannon, you start first.
Once again, all sounding really, really plausible. Gee, you know, I'm just going to go with the old trick of going with C, thinking that that's always right. No, really, I do think that sounds pretty reasonable.
He outsourced his entire job to programmers in China for 20% of what he made.
Yep, I'm going to go with that.
I read all about this one.
Oh,
so,
yeah, that's not fair. He's got to guess last then.
So should I guess?
Let him go.
I am also going to guess C, only because if anybody's read that Tim Ferriss book, The 4-Hour Work Week, one of his tricks is if you have work to outsource to India or China, can save a lot of money and save a lot of time. So.
All right.
And I'm going to agree with both of you because I read all about this guy and he had a great thing going there for a while.
Yeah. It's a great freaking idea.
It's amazing because it is. It is so easy. It is as easy as going on a website to outsource to other countries to do menial work.
What's even worse is there's a site. Oh, God, I have to ask my roommate what this is, but it's something where basically something about $5 or something like that, where you can basically try to hire or buy things for $5.
Yeah, Fiverr.
Yeah. I was
F-I-V-V-E-R.
Astonished.
Yeah. Well, most of the things are ridiculous, though. They're like, I'll do a funny voice in your answering machine for $5.
Yeah, but there's also like graphics jobs and like crazy,
really?
Horrible things.
Well, wow. I was reading in the article about this guy. They had like an interview where he talked about how, you know, they asked him, well, what did you actually do every day? And he said, well, I'd spend the first 4 hours on Facebook.
And then I'd play World of Warcraft for 40 hours a week.
Yeah.
Do you mean two of these? All right, here's the next one. Stand-up arcades are almost impossible to find these days. So stand-up video game designers are trying all sorts of new things to try to get you to play. For example, A, after programming your name, sexual orientation, and age, the game will try to match you with other singles with similar scores. B, a game called The Last Bar Fight that rewards skilled players with cups of beer dispensed from the machine. Or C, converting classic 80s video games that exchange high scores to frequent flyer miles with participating airlines.
I want it to be C.
I want it to be C, too.
I want it to be right.
I never get my Dig Dug miles.
If you made that up, you're now going to be a billionaire.
Okay,
you need
to
do that.
I'd like to combine B and C, you know, so you get frequent flyer miles, but while you're playing, you get free cups of beer.
Shannon, what are you going to pick first?
I'm once again going to go with C.
C? Converting 80s video games to frequent flyer miles? Okay, Eric.
I wanted to be C, but I'm going to go with A. They're going to try to match people up.
Okay.
Yeah, probably right.
I feel like B is something that already exists in Japan.
Sex, drugs, and frequent flyer miles.
Yeah, I'm going to go with C because I want it to be so real.
Well, none of you got it right. It was B.
Really?
Game called The Last Bar Fight. You put a cup in the front, and if you get a high score, it starts dispensing beer.
What kind of beer? Where do you get the beer? Can you buy it under 18 or 20?
Only,
what,
the what's the drinking age? Keystone Light.
The airline miles was my idea.
There you go. Patent it. Patent
Aaron,
it right now.
That is brilliant.
All right, last one. Technology and fashion team up this month to give us a dress whose material turns see-through when the wearer becomes aroused. B, a business suit that sends out electric shock when it detects a body inhaling nicotine to help with quitting smoking. Or C, using nanotube fiber technology, scientists have made skin-tight cloth that can withstand and distribute energy from high-velocity impacts, making the wearer virtually bulletproof and creating the possibility of a functional superhero costume. Eric, you start first. Or do you know this one too?
I've seen this one. Oh? I've actually seen it in person.
All right.
Oh.
Well, then we start with Brad then.
Well, I'm gonna go with C because that sounds like something the military would develop.
Nanotube fiber technology.
Nanotube
Superman costume.
Fiber technology. But what was A again?
A is a dress whose material turns see-through when the wearer becomes aroused.
Yeah, see, that's not a good
idea.
Okay,
who is that for?
Hey,
honey, can you wear this?
At least it's not, it turns see-through when he becomes
At least
aroused.
It's not pants, because, like, guys are like, what are you doing? I'm thinking about math. Oh, no.
All right, yeah. Shannon.
Well, even though, I don't know, jeez, it's just horrible, horrible, horrible fear that A is actually something, and then they're just it's going to make Halloween
when you do nicotine.
A.
Okay.
Oh, just because, you know, Halloween's going to just get even sluttier now.
All right, so A for you?
Yeah, I think A is probably
a
thing.
Well, okay, the thing that I've seen wasn't quite exactly that, but it was like this would be the next stage of it. It would be C, the fabric that disperses the energy.
I made that up.
You made that up.
I was
at, I think it was like the Wired Next Fest.
Uh-huh.
And they actually had a guy who had, it was more of a, like padding.
Okay.
But you could hit him with a baseball bat and he didn't feel it.
Well, I figured it was kind of like a lot of a blade.
That man has no bones.
Well, the one that I directly got was a dress whose material turns see-through when
That's
the wearer
really
becomes
I
bad.
Knew it.
Really?
And once again, I'm asking, who is going to buy this? Oh, yeah. Hey, honey. Oh, my little girlfriends and I, we're going to go out, we're going to go shopping, and we're going to get dresses that say, yes, I like you in no uncertain terms. I mean,
yeah,
come on.
Well,
really?
It would cut out the whole games thing because I'm sick of women to play games. Am I right, guys?
The question is, does it actually say on the tag that it does that, or are they just selling you a nice black party dress?
It was just on the runway right now. You cannot buy it at Target yet.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
All right. That's the end of everything. Give out, like, some websites and for each person here before you leave, like, where we can contact
well,
you. Or do you have anything you're promoting? I know you have a group.
Yep. I've got Stereo Sisters, which is educational outreach, mentorship, and networking for women and girls getting into technology via 3D or whatever. So if you're interested in learning more about 3D, you can contact us, info@stereosisters.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr and Pinterest and all the other good stuff. And I did mention that our Tumblr feed, which is at Stereo Sisters 3D, has that wonderful list of all of the Sony 4K theaters in
Perfect.
North America. There's some really wonderful other 3D sites out there, and Eric actually has probably the whole list of them.
I'm currently the president of the LA 3D Club, which is actually a...
Is that different than the Stereoscopic Society that I saw, that I went with you at the church?
No,
it was the Stereoscopic Club of Southern California.
Okay, so same group.
Yeah. It's la3dclub.com is easier to remember.
Than Stereo Club of Southern California.
Yeah.
right.
But the organization's been around since 1955. It started as a photography club for people shooting with stereo realist cameras.
Mm.
And over the years, it's grown into sort of this umbrella group that brings together 3D collectors, enthusiasts, people working at the amateur and professional level,
right?
Like all under one roof to share and exchange ideas. And we do monthly movie screenings and photography competitions and all kinds of public outreach. We have if for people who are in the Los Angeles area, we have a monthly meeting that's open to the public. You can get all the information at la3dclub.com. And then I also personally, I've been going through YouTube and finding good 3D clips.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been sort of curating a channel there.
So you have a 3D YouTube channel.
I have a 3D YouTube channel.
Great.
Oh, that's
so
great.
If you want to see 3D clips, and I actually, I probably do to update it a bit sometime soon, but you can go to 3DIY.net.
I'll put all these links on our website.
Cool.
So if you send me the links, I'll post them so people can get there.
Okay,
wonderful.
Great. If you want people to go there.
And I would suggest for people who aren't in the LA area, there are a lot of these stereo clubs that have been around
absolutely
for 40, 50 years.
Mm. Worldwide, in fact.
Worldwide, yeah. So if whatever city you're in, if you do a Google search, or you can even go to the National Stereoscopic Association's website.
Yes, the NSA, folks.
Yeah. Stereoworld.org is their website, and I believe they have a listing of the regional clubs that you can find around the world.
And they have, around the world. They do have the international chapters as well.
So for anyone who's interested in learning more about 3D or making their own or just figuring out, okay, how do I hook my Blu-ray player to my TV? These clubs are really a great place to go because you'll meet a lot of people who are already involved.
Perfect.
Very
also,
nice.
Also, should we be crossing our fingers for Oscar night?
Absolutely.
You're involved.
It would be involved with
the Simpsons.
I was the lead stereographer on Maggie Simpson in The Longest Daycare. Got to work with David Silverman, who directed the Simpsons feature film, co-directed Monsters Inc., and has been a Simpsons animator since it was a segment on the Tracy Ullman show. 26 years ago.
So everybody choose that in your Oscar pool.
So.
It's really amazing.
As we record this, there's still one more day of Oscar voting, but I imagine by the time people are listening to this, you probably can't vote for.
Do you hear that, Clooney?
Anymore.
Vote.
But, you know, it's an honor to have worked on something that got nominated.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And it's really brilliant. It really, really is. It's such a unique thing to see because it's traditional hand-drawn animation, but it's volumetric. It's got roundness. It's.
Wow.
Eric's a genius. He's one of my personal heroes.
Awesome.
He really is. You know that.
That's great.
Brad, you have anything you want to promote?
Oh, I've got a book on Amazon.com. It's called The Last Will and Testament of Ernie Politics. It's a homage to the old L.A. Noir and books of Dashiel Hammett and Raymond Chandler.
Ooh,
but it takes place.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, but it takes place in modern times, and the detective is a homeless guy. Searching for his best friend's killer. Huh? So,
very cool.
If you go to Amazon, search Ernie Politics or erniesmanifesto.com is my website. And also my sketch comedy group is Dry Hump Comedy, dryhumpcomedy.com. We do a lot of gross humor, as you can tell from our name.
That's awesome.
The
internet hates that stuff.
That's true. They do. They do.
Excellent. Thank you, everybody, for joining us and doing this.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. This has been so much fun.
And everybody out there, have a great Geek Week.
Thank you.